Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. It has been a while since most of us common folk have faced the possibility of thermonuclear obliteration. Of course, a mixed cadre of sober and maniacal minds have been thinking of its possibility all along, which for them, the nuclear arms race did not end with the collapse of communist Russia in 1991. Our brand new president has suddenly stopped the majority of us in our tracks, and similar to any striking or potential cataclysm, our daily lives have warped into instant apprehension and palpable dread far beyond our now obviously minuscule personal concerns of just yesterday. From the moment of Donald Trump's startling election, the most vocal and consistent concern has been his proximity to the nuclear trigger. The doomsday clock of the Association of Atomic Scientists was moved back to 2 minutes to midnight on Trump's inauguration day for the first time since the end of the Cold War. The fact that Trump as president can unilaterally unleash America's nuclear arsenal without any checks or balances has horrified quite a few. His impulsive airstrike against Syria last week was without notification of Congress, which has immediately raised qualms about a nuclear exchange between the United States and Russia a quarter of a century since the Cold War ended. There are, of course, many opinions as to Trump's sudden unilateral use of military action against Syria. Among them are that it was an iron fist poked at both China and North Korea, or a distracting threat to his detractors, domestic and foreign, who demand explanations for his extravagant corruptions, including the Russian election connection. Another possibility is more esoteric and has everything to do with his cruel sense of messianic megalomania, a lunatic vision that the human world of which he is the self-imagined apocalyptic master must be annihilated at his death, as in yore, when slaves were sacrificed to the corpse of a king or emperor. If this is indeed his diabolic delusion, he is well placed at the nuclear helm. Or in the words of David Ormsby Gore, it would indeed be a tragedy if the history of the human race proved to be nothing more than the story of an ape playing with a box of matches on a petrol dump. I think I should apologize in advance for my torturous pronunciation of the word nuclear, since I will be saying it so often on today's program. I would like to read something I wrote, 2 minutes to midnight. Everybody born since 1945 has lived his or her entire lives under the shadow of the mushroom cloud, which supersedes every other of humanity's icons. Most people would rather not be reminded that they live in the age of plutonium and that wherever they live on Earth, they are less than an hour away from a missile that has their address, despite post-Cold War reduction of weapons of mass destruction. Enough remain to obliterate the planet multiple times. The world has recently lurched away from the brink of nuclear war, yet its possibility is far from remote. Even now, a quarter century from the end of the Cold War and the ostensible cessation of the nuclear arms race and dismantling of the huge arsenals, it is an act of faith that at any instant deadly missiles have not been launched from somewhere. On a normal day, we might all look up and see spiky, umbrella-like contrails of nuclear weapons re-entering the planet's atmosphere, and all that was normal a few moments before will vanish forever. We have seen our world from space, small and frail, a mote in God's eye. The same technical mastery that sent rockets to the stars is capable also of sending them on a shorter, final journey of obliteration. The late Jonathan Schell wrote in his book, Fate of the Earth, that if a council were to be empowered by the people of the Earth to do whatever was necessary to save humanity from extinction by nuclear arms, it might well decide a good first step would be to order the destruction of all the nuclear weapons in the world. Yet that would not be good enough. nor would destroying blueprints how to make them. The real question is, how do we erase the knowledge of nuclear weapons from the human mind? To return to safety through technical measures, we would have to disarm matter itself, Shell wrote, something not even the physics of our time can teach us to do. We cannot uninvent nuclear weapons. The knowledge of them is with us for as long as Homo sapiens defies its own handicaps and dwells in the galaxy. If we are not smart enough to contain our atomic goblin, our rubbled planet will leave little trace that we once briefly and foolishly ruled Earth. Humanity will either obliterate or preserve itself. An indication that the species might be worth preserving will be its courage to try. A species' extinction might begin when increasing numbers of its members lose hope for themselves and their future, when they stop their inner clocks because they perceive life as unbearable or hopeless. A lasting effect must be a result of this despair, an enervating decline, a loss of will, and the cleverness indispensable for survival. The human race is not unlike any other life form that has lived temporarily on Earth. Like its individual members, the species must eventually die, and like a person, it can die at any age or stage of its development. The richness of its past, its dreams or schemes, its successes and failures, its hopes for a future, none of these is a case against death or extinction. The very quality that forced human rule over the Earth, our ruthless and intelligent violence, is the obstacle to our continued existence. We differ from our extinct predecessors in that our threatened oblivion is from our own industry and in the possibility that we might overcome our history and survive a while longer. Our troubles did not originate with the gods we invent, nor from the cosmos we hardly understand. The nuclear devil is our own, not a bad joke played on us by a malevolent deity, nor is it a divine instrument of hurrah for the faithful. For all its awesome power, and despite suspicions that it is basically intractable, nuclear technology is a product of human beings and a problem of human scope that can only be resolved by human beings. In the quite probable dystopian future humanity will most likely be forced to endure, explosive overpopulations, climate changes of catastrophic proportions and disastrous consequences, vast inequalities of wealth and erosion of human rights, mega-exploitation as well as fierce competition for increasingly scarce resources, and intensifying religious intolerance that will most likely lead to successfully endless wars, no one should be surprised that the ultimate catastrophe might eventually occur. The two nuclear bombs that ended World War II might have put an end to war for good. Instead, a nuclear arms race between two conflicting and aggressive ideologies, the United States and Communist Russia, allies and victors in the war against Nazism, divided the world on both sides of an iron curtain. Each developed huge stockpiles of nuclear weapons that were capable of obliterating the planet several times over. The result was a balance of terror defended by arguments that only nuclear parity could prevent a third world war. The U.S. and USSR spent hundreds of billions of dollars developing their nuclear arsenals, each government posing the threat of the other to continually escalate the race. They acted like two scorpions in a jar. The two superpowers raced through generations of nuclear weapons, blackmailing each other into increasing their arsenals and making treaties that allowed for more and deadlier weapons instead of eliminating any of them by mutual agreement. The more bizarre and dangerous the arms race got, so equally were official dismissals by both sides of the fears of Holocaust their actions precipitated. Finally, after nearly half a century, the always escalating arms race broke the Soviet Union, which was already fatally strained by internal contradictions and ruptures. Russian Premier Mikhail Gorbachev's remarkable personal appeal might have been a singular factor that put the brakes on the virtually out-of-control rush toward nuclear confrontation. Attempting to save his crumbling empire, Gorbachev tapped into the worldwide angst about nuclear weapons in order to slow down the arms race, which was bankrupting the USSR. He paradoxically succeeded in terminating the Cold War, but was unable to stop Soviet-Russian communism from imploding. The abrupt end of the Cold War between the United States and Soviet Russia and the shattering of the communist empire that followed precipitated new dangers. The nuclear shift was no longer a big power confrontation, but it was instead a different form of nuclear shadow hanging over the world that was not bound by the intricate series of treaties devised by the superpowers over half a century. With the Cold War over and the Soviet Union banished to history's dung heap, along with the bygone 20th century, it astonished and appalled. The United States, as the only reigning superpower, attempted to put in place a millennial form of Pax Americana by reinvigorating the high frontier Star Wars space satellite missile and laser system, which in theory might possibly be the ultimate of nuclear menace, capable of raining laser beams and missiles down upon any place on the planet. Contrarily, it has been depicted as a sci-fi delusion that is extravagant, inept, unnecessary, and destabilizing, quote unquote. The first American president of the 21st century, George W. Bush, who once said, "The Cold War is over forever," seemed eager to impose nuclear superiority over the rest of the world. The so-called Bush Doctrine's nuclear jingoism was basically that any other nation's nuclear arms were weapons of mass destruction, while the world obliterating U.S. arsenal acted as a nuclear deterrent. This doublethink resonates throughout current American foreign policy, which is nothing less than regression to nuclear blackmail. Be damned if you possess or develop nuclear weapons. Be damned if you don't. Although the armistice of World War I a century ago lasted less than a generation, it was a hope that humanity's addiction to warfare might finally end because war had become too horrible to bear. Ironically, that hope accompanied the larger fears of nuclear annihilation during the Cold War, that a balance of terror made warfare itself obsolete. That balance, as repulsive as it was, is yet regarded preferable to the post-Cold War uncertainty of wild-card nuclear expansion by so-called rogue nations or terrorist groups unrestrained by the possibility of collective oblivion. The original development and use of atomic bombs on Japan will be disputed long after World War II diminishes to history, as ancient as Caesar's campaigns in Gaul or the Greeks at Troy. The advent of the nuclear age might always be a topic of debate, although 1,000 years from now, the initial splitting of the atom will be as misty in memory as the discovery of fire or the first use of a hammer. For most of their lives, our ancestors lived in terror of each other. They lived in cities that were sacked and decimated to the last living creature. The males were impressed into armies and navies and died horribly on the pikes or were blasted by the cannon of other impressed serfs or citizens. Both men and women were slain for the slightest infraction, and they worked so unbearably hard for so little that most of them died considerably young. We have not done much better. The last century began with the most brutal slaughter in history, followed by a Second World War that temporarily wrecked most of the planet. We have the power at the beginning of this century, millennium, to permanently destroy the whole Earth. Nuclear power has rendered the nation-state and concomitant nationalism as dead as dinosaurs. Yet the death throes might lead to world suicide. Just as with the homelands of our ancestors, we have made armed camps of our nations, and like our ancestors, we have never seriously sought peace, and never for very long. Perhaps the only method of preventing the ultimate war lies not with merely scrapping the weapons of its probable conduct, though it is necessary as a beginning, they can always be rebuilt, but with the recognition of all of us as members of a very fragile human family. The term utopia has been scornfully applied to almost every idea or attempt toward what Albert Einstein called a universal civilization, and World Federation is generally dismissed as unrealistic and impossible, except as a dictatorial Third Reich or as a New World Order with the reigning superpower as directorate. Yet our histories suggest a drawing together. For thousands of years, separated by the massive barriers of mountains, oceans, deserts, and vast prairies of time, as well as dispersion, the human species moved its divergent parts into resumed contact through exploration and expanding populations. Families grew into tribes, which allied with or were conquered by other tribes, and formed cities and nations. Since World War II, divided by ancient biases, yet unified by mutual tremors, we have become a global civilization despite ourselves. World unity, a debatable dream in the past, is the only long-range solution to the prospect of universal devastation. Not to say that a world government, Einstein's universal civilization, will not be fraught with all of the pitfalls that mar every human governance, from small towns to huge multinational corporate conglomerates. A world government consisting of separate states or religions will certainly be as fractious, messy, and malevolently divisive and maliciously class competitive as the U.S. has been since its inception. All of our national woes will be magnified and compounded, as will those of every other nation, at least in the beginning. But as the European Union still struggles to find a unified identity from its diversities and divisive postpartums, Brexit, for example, so eventually would a world civilization that is at nascent parturition. The United Nations, which was born 72 years ago at the end of World War II upon the ashes of the failed League of Nations, is an imperfect example of an attempt at world unity. Its preamble stresses a determination to, quote, save succeeding generations from the scourge of war, which twice in our lifetimes has brought untold sorrow to mankind. The UN helped prevent the Cold War from turning into a Holocaust. It provided a valuable, though irritating, forum for world opinion, and its mere existence helped diffuse otherwise unendurable pressures in the turbulent years that followed World War II. In 1978, at the height of the Cold War, the UN declared, "Nuclear weapons pose the greatest danger to humankind and the survival of civilization. It is essential to halt and reverse the nuclear arms race in all its aspects to avert the danger of war involving nuclear weapons. The ultimate goal in this context is the complete elimination of nuclear weapons. The most effective guarantee against the danger of nuclear war and the use of nuclear weapons is nuclear disarmament and the complete elimination of nuclear weapons." Armageddon is the place for the last battle at the end of the world, located in the Middle East, where bloody wars are being fought by a rise of religious fanaticism. Almost all religions prophesize a final battle or cataclysm that will end human life. Humanity is now at prophecy. All of our history has led us to the savage frontier of our most primitive fears. We are as much under assault by barbarity as were the civilizations of antiquity, only from within our own. Those who are maddened by their fear of death eschew life and make themselves into death's instruments, fearfully willing to murder all flesh in exchange for a chimera of eternal life. Their priests openly pray for nuclear holocaust and exhort their flocks to assist bringing about the day of redemption. From this grows a general sense of helplessness to reverse the runaway technology we have conceived, a response that it is God's will and irreversible. The military castes are as irresponsible. They speak of themselves as protectors of the peace, yet paralyze themselves to any other worldview except the ultimate battle, which is, after all, the shrine of their profession. The dinosaurs, the great thunder lizards that lived on Earth hundreds of times longer than humanity, might have perished from a huge collision of a large rock with the planet. Our extinction should be as dramatic if we continue as we are. The difference is that we have taken charge of our evolution. We can murder our old mother, Gaia, or let her live a while longer. If we walk around with our hands in our pockets and whine that there is nothing any of us can do to stop the incoming inevitability of extinction, then we are already dead. We have killed the spirit essential to impose our will upon the forces rushing us toward the abyss. As Elmer Davis said, The first and greatest commandment is, don't let them scare you. And that was something I wrote 2 minutes to midnight. And now, something else I wrote, teaching about nuclear war. Although school children conducted duck and cover drills throughout most of the Cold War, Americans were reluctant to teach their children about nuclear war while building ever more grotesque weapons. An example was an attempt by Oregon to establish a curriculum pertaining to nuclear war in the state's public elementary and high schools. The idea was to develop a program of the history of the nuclear age and the arms race that rapidly developed between the United States and Soviet Russia, the consequences of the use of nuclear weapons, the effects upon national economies and ambitions, and alternate forms of resolving conflict short of war in general. The issue caused intense and heated debate in the state legislature. Its supporters, mostly Democrats, said teaching children about nuclear war might be an important step toward averting Holocaust. Opponents, mostly Republicans, said it would create fear in children and weaken the nation's resolve to defend itself, as well as question its destiny of manifest destiny. Carolyn Adamson, who was legislative aide to Clatsop County Representative Tom Hanlon, who supported the bill, he was a Democrat, said that children are concerned about life in the nuclear age and should have their concerns addressed in the classroom. Eugene Representative Carl Hostica, also a Democrat, said that up until then, the legislature had only passed memorials to Congress about the nuclear arms race. Giving children the opportunity to learn about war was, he said, the legislature's first concrete step toward preventing nuclear disaster. One who disagreed was Gold Beach Representative Walt Schroeder, a Republican. He said that nuclear education should be left up to parents and not taught in the schools. He cited large numbers of teenage suicides as indication of the anxieties that information about nuclear arms might produce. Schroeder thought children should be protected from knowing what might hurt them, and that such knowledge would only dissolve their will in the struggle against communism. Children are not taught to distinguish between good and evil, he said, and that education about nuclear war would only brainwash them. He compared teaching about nuclear war with sexual education, which had, he said, produced more pregnancies, abortions, and homosexuality than before it was taught. Schroeder's opinions represented the far right, but were not too different from more moderate Republicans such as John Minnis from Portland. A former policeman, he thought the bill unnecessary and would manipulate children into accepting what he called a global philosophy that would countenance global government. Minnis differed from Schroeder in that he believed children should learn about nuclear war, but the schools were inadequate to teach it. He said that children should be taught how to think and grasp fundamentals before such dramatic and complex issues as the nuclear arms race would put before them. He also thought elementary children were too young to understand and too prone to anxieties and nightmares about what the courses would reveal to them. During the debate in the House, Minnis said that arguments about nuclear weapons were more volatile than the weapons themselves. He said that such an educational program could undermine allegiance to the country and indoctrinate children in extremist policies. He said that such anti-nuclear groups as the Oregon-based Citizens Action for a Lasting Security, CALS, would use the issue to manipulate children into opposing the arms race. In a later interview, Minnis advocated support for the Star Wars space missile program, which he said would end the arms race with more certainty than a nuclear freeze. If there was an ideological dividing line, supporters for teaching children about nuclear war were for the most part opponents of the nuclear arms race. Those who supported the arms race were generally opposed to teaching about it. Essentially, the elected officials who did not want kids to know about nuclear war were those whose political policies encouraged it. A 10-year-old girl wrote a letter to an Oregon newspaper after watching a televised movie about nuclear war. The day after, that she was afraid for her future. I don't want war to happen, she wrote. If a bomb does explode, I think I would rather die than live. Now when I think of my future, I think of nothing. I hope a war will never happen. And that was Teaching About Nuclear War, which I wrote. And as an epilogue, 5 days ago, on April 8th, the mutual birthday of both Gautama Buddha, traditionally in 563 BCE, and Juan Ponce de Leon, 1460 CE, were commemorated. Each sought his own version of everlasting life, Siddhartha through various reincarnations, and Ponce de Leon searching for a fountain of youth. On the other hand, there is nothing more certain than death and taxes. The deadline, pardon the term, for taxes is Tuesday, April 18th this year, because of a federal 3-day holiday over the weekend, if the first certainty does not, on a mega scale, obliterate all earthly life in the next 5 days. There is concern that North Korea might commemorate its Founders Day on Saturday, April 15th, with another nuclear test, and also its threat to nuke the U.S. at any sign of aggression, quote unquote. So on that note, I terminate today's program with a 3-paragraph epitaph by my friend Michael Graham, who for many years was Arch Cape's fire marshal, and who is also a writer of stories and novels. Ground Zero by M.L. Graham. More brilliant than 1,000 noonday suns, the flash and racing inferno poured down from the sky, and in an instant a countryside turned to ash. Little girls with delicate skin were cremated in pink dresses. Old men on park benches vanished. Gone also were the benches, and the shade trees flared into burning forests. Shadows were burnt into the ground the instant blood and bone boiled away. Seeds that had contained such promise were scorched to hard, lifeless pits by a cosmic zephyr traveling at the speed of death. Love and hope, in its way, were disintegrated. The giants of war had flung their spears. With unyielding and pitiless menace, they had squeezed a formula for horror out of the earth, then shaped laws around bombs that turned the simple atom into the destroyer of worlds. The bombs quickly became the intent of laws, and the laws became hopelessly snarled with the laws and bombs of enemies. The drift to the final war was inevitable because nothing was done to prevent it. A shower of radiation particles fell gently like an invisible snow upon the charred land, covering the smoking rubbish piles that had been alive moments before. There was silence, a crazy kind of silence. And that was Ground Zero by Michael Graham, which was first published in the North Coast Times Eagle on February 29th, 1980. And a poem by my old friend E.A. Anderson, Last Gasp Earth, Terror Flash, Hydrogen Blast, A False Quickening, Left to Fester, Slowly, Giving Death's Head, Ugly Reality, While Sins Left Undone, Seed the Galaxy. And that was by E.A. Anderson. And this has been Michael McCusker. Happy Resurrection Day. And remember KMUN's 34th birthday, Monday, April 17th.